Good evening and welcome to a one-night stand with the big bands. One of the most beautiful of all the big band themes, that's Moonlight Serenade, introducing music by Glenn Miller and his orchestra. And our special guest on a one-night stand will be George T. Simon, the well-known author and big band authority, whose recently published book is Glenn Miller and His Orchestra. This is Arnold Dane, and a one-night stand is brought to you on WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut, by WTIC and by Russo Chevrolet, across from Bradley Air Museum in Windsor Locks, where both sales and service are outstanding. To begin our program tonight, let's listen to the final Glenn Miller Band, and many say the finest big band ever assembled, the Glenn Miller AAF Band, featuring Mel Powell at the piano and Peanuts Hucko on clarinet. This is Mission to Moscow. The Glenn Miller AAF Band and Mission to Moscow. In a moment, we'll meet George T. Simon. There's no better time to appreciate the beauty of the great outdoors than the summertime. And there's no better way to see beautiful country than behind the wheel of a 1974 Chevy Blazer, featured now at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. The Blazer is one of the newest models in Chevy's lineup. It was designed for toughness, built as if there were no roads at all. Featured on every Chevy Blazer are a frame made of high-strength carbon steel, a reinforced hood, double-wall front fenders, and an energy-absorbing steering column. A new power brake system, matching stopping power to total vehicle weight, has been incorporated into each and every Blazer. Options on the Blazer include a comfort tilt steering wheel, air conditioning, and an AM or AM/FM radio. See and test drive a new Chevy Blazer at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo Chevrolet, directly across from the Bradley Air Museum. just a short drive from Hartford. When it comes to Chevrolets, the people at Russo are experts. And now let's reintroduce our dear friend and noted big band authority, George T. Simon. On part one of this program a month ago, George, we did a lot of talking about early Glenn Miller, the early years, the band that failed, and now we're up to the band that made it. But I think to begin our conversation tonight, I'll ask you that stock question. What was Glenn Miller really like?
Very complex man. Very difficult man in many ways. Very decent man. Very kind man. If he got to know you, and if you got to know him. He had a very hard exterior. He was very hard to get through to him on any sort of an emotional basis because he was hiding his own emotions so much. Mm-hmm. It was part of his upbringing, never to show your emotions. And, you know, it was a very strict type of upbringing, which, was, as I said earlier, was very common in those days. I liked him very much. And those of us who were privileged to get close to him liked him very much. Others couldn't stand him because he was so strict and he was so unbending. He was a terribly stubborn man, extremely stubborn. I had a big falling out with him one time, which lasted quite a while. And it wasn't until I pinned him up against the wall and said, for crying out loud, what is this all about?
I remember reading about this, George. Yeah. You didn't know what was troubling him.
Yeah, and he wouldn't show his emotion. He wouldn't, except to show anger, you know, but he would never unburden himself. And finally, I got him to do that, and when he realized what it was all about, and we both realized what it was all about, it was so ridiculous that from then on everything was okay again.
Mm-hmm. What happened to Glenn Miller once he became an enormous success? Did he change very much?
No, I don't think he changed very much, though a lot of people thought he did. I remember one time I was backstage with him up at the Paramount Theater in his dressing room, and he said to me, you know, this success is okay in one way, but another way it's just terrible because I just can't be the kind of person I want to be anymore. People ask me to do so many things all the time, and I've got to tell lies to get out of them, because if I told them in plain truth that I just don't have time, they wouldn't take it. They wouldn't believe me. And he said the pressures are so tremendous when you have success that it's impossible, really, to be yourself, to do exactly what you want to do and still remain successful.
I remember one story about him, how he would, when his mind was made up about something, he was unbending. And you'll have to give me the details on this, George, because the particulars have slipped my mind, but I know I read it in one of your books, I think it was in the Big Bands, about the fact that some music critics were at a table and enjoyed themselves, food and drink all night long, and said, Mr. Miller will take care of the check, and he sent it right back to them.
Right, that happened at Glen Island Casino, yeah. A party of about six came in, and the bill came to about $75, which was tremendous in those days. You know, that's like about $200 now, I guess. And Glenn was struggling. He had no money at all. And when the check came over to him, the waiter said that so-and-so said you would pay the check. And Glenn said, oh, really? And he took the check and walked over to the guy and said, I'm sorry, if this is what it's going to cost me to get a write-up in your paper, I can't afford it, and gave it back to him.
Oh, well, good for him.
Yeah.
Which of his musicians liked him?
Tex Beneke, Willie Schwartz, Ernie Caceres, Hal McIntyre, Chummy McGregor worshipped him.
Yes.
Trigger, Alpert, Mo Pertlin, he got along very well. The trumpet section, people didn't like him so much. Mickey Mickle liked him pretty much. Billy May hated him at the time, but has mellowed a great deal since then. I never did get to talk to Ray Anthony or Johnny Best. I know Johnny Best was unhappy with the band, though. Ray Anthony was never a happy marriage anyway. Trigger Alpert, and he got along very well. Among the trombones, Paul Tanner liked him tremendously, and Jimmy Pretty said he never really got to know Glenn until he was in the Army with him, and then he really began to appreciate him. And Frankie D'Onofrio was a nice, quiet guy who got along well with everybody. Mm-hmm. But there were others in the band who didn't like him so much. But I think even now, in retrospect, those who didn't like him too much realize now what he was trying to do then, rather.
Yes, and have great respect for him.
Yes,
sure.
Yeah.
Let's listen to more Glenn Miller music. We'll hear one from the Civilian Band after this, but this again features the AAF Band. Bernie Priven on open trumpet, Zeke Zarchi muted, Tuxedo Junction. Thank you. Great broadcasts for the AAF band before a crowd of servicemen who truly appreciated it, and well, they should. We'll listen to just one recording in our one-night stand tonight that features the civilian band and most of the vocalists on it. Let's talk about the Glenn Miller vocalists, George, and begin with the great all-star Tex Beneke. Where exactly did Glenn find Tex?
Gene Krupa found him. And actually what happened... The guy who really found him was Sam Donahue, who was in Gene Krupa's band and wanted Tex to go with Gene Krupa, but Gene Krupa had no use for another tenor man in the band. So either Gene or Sam had told Glenn about Tex, and he was out in Detroit at the time with the band out there, and Glenn contacted him, and he was always his favorite, as you probably know.
Yes, he sure was.
There's a wonderful story about Tex and Glenn that Tex told me, which I have in the book also. When we did the Metronome All-Star dates, we did them at 12 o'clock at night. Now, on this particular year, Tex had won as fourth tenor. And so there are two tenors in the band, second tenor and fourth tenor. He was a top fourth tenor man, which means generally pretty tenor rather than jazz, playing jazz. And we asked Tex to do the date with us. Well, he said he could. But then Glenn said, only after you talked to Glenn, and he and Glenn had worked out something, a very tricky way of doing it. See, Glenn was a great disciplinarian, and he didn't want anybody to do anything except work for the band. So that when it came time for Tex to do this thing, Glenn said, I can't let you do it under ordinary circumstances. I can't set a precedent. But Tex, I'll tell you what you do. He said, long about 12 o'clock at night, you start griping. And you keep on griping until I get so mad, I'll tell you to go home. And you can go home, and instead of going home, you go over and do the all-star date. See? And nobody else in the band knew this. So came the last set in the evening, and Glenn called up some number, the new number, and Glenn and Tex looked and said, oh, Glenn, not this, and Glenn sort of stared at him. He did another number, and Tex said, oh, God, I have to play this number, gee whiz, you know, and Glenn again stared at him. Meanwhile, Ernie Caceres, who was a very close friend of Tex, sitting next to him, kept nudging Tex, you know, take it easy, Tex, take it easy. And finally, the third number, Tex said, oh, for God, no, we're going to play that. And Glenn said, look, Tex, if you don't like it, why don't you leave? And Tex said, okay, I will. And whereupon he picked up his horns and started to leave the bandstand, and Ernie got up and said, well, if he goes, I go too. And things were never quite the same after that between Glenn and Ernie, because Glenn knew where Texas where Ernie's loyalty
was. And loyalty was such an important ingredient.
Right, to him. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, loyalty played a role in his hiring of Ray Eberle.
Or in his keeping of Ray Eberle, because Ray, it didn't work out as a singer for quite a while. Yeah, eventually he did. He fit the band very well. But then he and Glenn were having a lot of troubles later on, and Glenn still stuck with him as long as he could, and finally conflicting stories about why Ray left. Ray tells one story, others tell another story, but finally even loyalty could not withstand some of the problems they were having, so Ray left the band.
What about Marion Hutton? How good a vocalist do you think Marion Hutton was?
Not good. And she didn't think so either.
Yeah.
Yeah, she told me that. She said, you know, I was just a thing in that band. I was an entertainer. I was never much of a singer, and I know it. She has since turned into a fantastic person. I spent some time with her out in the West Coast when I was doing research for this book, and she's getting her either BA or MA now in philosophy and psychology out there, and she's where she was originally, you know, just another band chick, what they called the Dopey Duchess and various dizzy names like that. She's now a very well-adjusted, bright human being who's very interested in other people and doing a lot of work out there for other groups, for other people. Beautiful person.
This is the band's first million seller. It features just about everybody vocally, particularly, though, Tex Beneke and the Modern Airs. And I'm sure you've already recognized the opening strains to that popular train, the Chattanooga Choo Choo.
Beside partner, it's my day. Bend an ear and listen to my version
of a really solid Tennessee excursion.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga Choo-Choo?
Yes, yes, track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
Can you afford to board Chattanooga Choo-Choo?
I got my fare
and just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania station about a quarter to four. Read a magazine and then you're in Baltimore.
Dinner in the diner, nothing could be finer
than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina.
When you hear the whistle blowing eight to the bar, then you know that Tennessee is not very far.
Shamalala calling, gotta keep it rolling.
Ooh, ooh, Chattanooga, there you are.
There's gonna be a certain party at the station.
Satin and lace.
I used to call Funny Face. She's gonna cry until I tell her that I'll never roam.
So Chattanooga choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
get aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
all aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga, Chattanooga choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga choo-choo.
Tex Beneke, the Modern Airs, Glenn Miller, and his civilian band, and that's the Chattanooga Choo Choo. Let's move along now to the AAF band, if we can, in our conversation with George T. Simon. As I've mentioned earlier on this program, George, some say that this was the greatest big band ever.
It was a fantastic band. It did everything so well. It was an exciting band, had great arrangements, great spirit, and of course, magnificently rehearsed. And because the guys were together all day long, you know, and Glenn could rehearse them whenever he wanted to, and believe me, he did. They rehearsed constantly, and they... To show you how great the band was, when they were over in Europe, in England, they found they were going to go to France, they did something like what amounted to 50 LPs in 3 days, my God, you know. Unbelievable amount of stuff that these guys could do. They were... beautifully trained, and fantastic musicians, because Glenn was able to get practically anybody he wanted into this band, because he would just requisition them. If a guy was going to go into the service and knew about it, in time he knew how to do it, he'd get in touch with Glenn. And so he had a band that was unbelievable. Ray McKinley on drums, Mel Powell on piano, Carmen Mastron on guitar, Trigger on bass, it was a rhythm section. And he had string section from some of Toscanini's men, quite a few men from the Cleveland Symphony. And he had trumpet players like Bernie Priven, who had been with Artie Shaw, and Bobby Nichols, who had a great trumpet player, who had been with Warren Monroe, and Zeke Zarchi was his lead trumpet player, who had been with Glenn, of course, and had been with Benny Goodman, and Artie Shaw, and Bob Crosby. And some great trombone players. Well, of course, there was Jimmy Pretty, who had been with Glenn, and two other very good trombone players. Three of them, Larry Hall, Nat Peck, and Johnny Halliburton, all fine trombone players. The saxist he had on clarinet was Peanuts Hucko, who never played much jazz clarinet until he got with Glenn.
A great clarinetist.
Yeah, and Glenn saw the potential in Peanuts. Peanuts was better known as a tenor sax man, but here Glenn had him playing clarinet. He had Hank Freeman of Artie Shaw's band on lead sax, and Chuck Gentry from Harry Jane's band on baritone. It was a great band.
And a huge band, too.
Huge band, yeah.
No civilian conductor could have a band that
big. No, and Johnny Desmond, who he was not that famous and was the singer. Tony Martin had been the singer, and he left to go into OCS, Officers Candidate School, and Johnny Desmond took over.
And did a beautiful job,
Wonderful
too.
Wonderful job.
He gave us a couple of good interviews on this program about his relationship with Glenn Miller, and how Glenn Miller told him, if I'd wanted Sinatra, I would have gotten Sinatra. If I wanted Tony Martin, I'd have Tony Martin. I want Johnny Desmond, so sing like Johnny Desmond.
Right, yeah.
And he said it changed his whole approach to the music
business.
That's
right, yeah. Yeah, Johnny told me the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of Glenn Miller and the AAF band and that fine vocalist Johnny Desmond, here he is with the Crew Chiefs. And oh, what a beautiful morning.
God.
a tremendous recording by the Glenn Miller AAF Band, a vocal by Johnny Desmond and the crew chiefs. Oh, what a beautiful morning. You're listening to A One-Night Stand being brought to you on WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut, by Russo Chevrolet of Windsor Locks and by WTIC. This is Arnold Dane. These days, it's almost impossible to give your car all the care it needs to stay in top condition without professional help. That's why it's important to buy from a dealer who feels service is equally as important as sales. When you purchase a car from Russo Chevrolet and Windsor Locks, you found a dealer you can rely on. Russo is a full-service Chevrolet dealer. Their experienced service staff is ready to handle any problem your car presents them with. With the aid of an electronic engine analyzer, a highly sensitive testing device, they can detect any malfunction in your engine and correct it promptly and accurately. If for any reason your car should require body or upholstery work, Russo Chevrolet offers you the services of one of the finest body and upholstery shops in the area. So for quality cars and dependable service, visit Russo Chevrolet, just a short drive from Hartford. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo Chevrolet, across from the Bradley Air Museum in Windsor Locks. That's R-U-S-S-O, Russo Chevrolet. Before we get back to our conversation with George T. Simon and listen to what George has to say about Glenn Miller's widow, Helen Miller, and the children, let's listen to another one by the AAF Band with the likes of Mel Powell, Bernie Priven, and the great drummer Ray McKinley featured. This is another of those which carried over with a similar arrangement from the civilian band into the AAF ranks, the Anvil Chorus.
Thank you.
Ray McKinley's great drumming on that recording of Anvil Chorus with the Glenn Miller AAF Band. Now let's continue conversing with George T. Simon. George, in everything that I've read or heard about Glenn Miller, I am left with the impression that he was a super patriot. Am I correct?
Yes, extremely so. But you know something very interesting? Do you know that he applied for a commission first in the Navy and was turned down?
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. I've got in the book here, I've got even got a letter from Bing Crosby, a recommendation, which I found in the files for Glenn. And he was turned down by the Navy. And then he wrote a very impassioned letter to the Army, which is we have in complete detail here in the book, why he wanted to join, what he thought he could do for the Army. So the Army took him.
And the Army set him up at Yale, and, gee, that's where he got his musicians together, and you spent some time with him there, did you not?
I was in the band. I used to drum next to Ray McKinley, as a matter of fact, in the marching band on the green, and also did PR for the band. And it was quite an experience. I sat in a couple of times with the big dance band, but Glenn made me so nervous that I couldn't do anything at all. He was a rough man to be in front of. Yeah. Especially if you're not a very good musician, as I was, certainly was not. You know, there's no Ray McKinley.
Is Ray McKinley a good drummer?
Fantastic.
I think he's one of the most underrated.
I think he's a fantastic drummer and just a fantastic human being.
Yeah.
One of the great people in this world is Ray McKinley. I can't say enough good things about him.
Well, he was sure the right arm of Glenn Miller with this band.
Well, he took over the dance band after Glenn was lost, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Ray was smart enough never to intrude too much in the Miller band when Glenn was there, although he did bring along some of his own arrangements, and the band would play some of Ray's own arrangements, which broadened the scope of the band somewhat, and Glenn liked them, so he let Ray use them.
Was it at this point that Glenn Miller suggested that you write his biography for him, or did that come before he got into the service?
That was before he was in the service. It was one time, I remember he asked me to come down and meet him at the Victoria Barbershop, the Hotel Victoria in New York. That's where he had his haircut, and where he did business very often because he couldn't be interrupted by other things. If he wanted to talk to one person, he'd ask that person to meet him there, and I did. And he said, I'd like you to write my biography. I was thrilled, of course, until he told me what he wanted to call it. He said, let's call it something like, the band business brought me $745,681, or some such, you know, figure like that. And right away, it struck a wrong note with me, because it was going to be a very commercial type of thing, which I wasn't, those days, I was strictly an idealist. I mean, I worked for Metronome magazine by the time I was finished working for them, 20 years after having been there, I was making $105 a week as editor-in-chief, so you see, I was quite an idealist. Mm-hmm. And that didn't strike me the right way. And also, I don't think I've ever told anybody this, Arnold, but I wanted to investigate it further. So I went up to see my brother, who was Dick Simon, who was the founder of Simon & Schuster. And Glenn and his manager, Mike Nightoff, and I went, not Glenn, I'm sorry, just Mike Nightoff and I went up to see Dick. And we talked to him about it, and he said, I think this would make a very good magazine article. And that's all. Yeah. And that, of course, just corroborated what I felt, in a sense. It gave me another excuse not to do it. Also, maybe I didn't feel I was ready to be able to do a book like that, because writing a biography is one heck of a job. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize how tough it could be until I tried this one.
Wrote this one. Yeah. Thank heaven you got around to writing this one, though. One of the other loose ends, and one thing that I'm asked about so frequently, is about Glenn's family. You've mentioned his wife, Helen. Did she look at all like June Allison?
Yes, she was very much like June Allison.
Is that right?
Picture, yes. And Jimmy Stewart, as I said before, was very much like Jimmy Stewart.
How did she put up with this kind of life? Glenn was away a great deal of the time.
Oh, she was wonderful. She was just a warm, very bright, and very strong-willed human being. It's very funny. One of the funniest stories I've ever heard is the story that June McIntyre, who lives in Westbrook, by the way, mm-hmm. Hal's widow, told me. She was very close to Helen, and she agreed, as many of us have, that this was a beautiful marriage. But she said they had some fights, as all people do. She said, but the only real fight I ever heard them have was one time when Glenn came home, and he and Helen started arguing, and there's a culmination of an argument that had been going on for 10 years, and it really turned out to be a dilly. And you know what they argued about? Which way the toilet paper should fall from the roll, from underneath or from on top.
A really troubled marriage.
Yeah, well, you can see how human he really was.
Is Helen still alive?
No, she died in 1966. Uh-huh. But the two children are there, of course. Steve is they're both adopted children. Steve was adopted before Glenn went overseas. Johnny, his daughter, was adopted after he went overseas. I never saw him.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and it was very, very touching to me because I went out to interview her, and it turned out that in a sense she was interviewing me because she wanted to find out about her father. She'd never seen him, never known
him. What was my father really like?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And I hope she gets a pretty good idea from this book. She was tremendously cooperative. I had two sessions with her. The second session, I went out to our house, and she had a trunk brought in from the garage, a steamer trunk just filled with photos and all sorts of memorabilia. And she said, help yourself.
Oh,
and
heaven.
About 50 of the almost 250 illustrations in the book came from her.
Neither of the children then remembers Glenn at all.
No, no.
Not at all. And they were both interested, of course, in finding out everything that they could about him. Is either of them interested in music?
No, not the slightest, so I can figure out. Steve was a policeman for a while, and then now sells guns. He's very interested in guns. Johnny has two children. And is married out in the West Coast, and her neighbors don't even know who she is.
Is that right?
Yeah. Uh huh. And in the book, I haven't even revealed her last name because she's asked me not to.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
George, here's another of the famous Glenn Miller civilian hits, which was taken over to the AAF band. The crew chiefs and Artie Melvin are featured with this. Here's that familiar jukebox Saturday night.
Mopping up soda pop rickies to our heart's delight.
Dancing to swing blue quickies, jukebox Saturday night.
Goodman and Kaiser and Miller help to make things bright.
Mix some hot drinks of vanilla, jukebox Saturday night. They put nothing past us,
me and Honeyland. Making one Coke last us
till it's time to scram.
Money we really don't need bad, we make out all right.
Let me up the guy feed that jukebox Saturday night.
After sipping a soda we got a scheme. Somebody else played the record machine. It's so easy to say pet names when you listen to the trumpet of Harry James.
We love to hear that tenor croon whenever the ink spots sing a tune. If I didn't know why the roses grow, then I wouldn't know why the roses grow.
Honey child, if I didn't know all the little things I'm supposed to know, then I sure wouldn't be one of them dare ink spots.
If I didn't know.
Bo, 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 bo.
Money, we really don't need it. We'll make out all right.
That's from one of their broadcasts, of course, the Glenn Miller AAF Band, the crew chiefs, and Artie Melvin featured in Jukebox Saturday Night. There's no better time to appreciate the beauty of the great outdoors than the summertime. And there's no better way to see beautiful country than behind the wheel of a 1974 Chevy Blazer.
featured now at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. The Blazer is one of the newest models in Chevy's lineup. It was designed for toughness, built as if there were no roads at all. Featured on every Chevy Blazer are a frame made of high-strength carbon steel, a reinforced hood, double-wall front fenders, and an energy-absorbing steering column. A new power brake system matching stopping power to total vehicle weight has been incorporated into each and every Blazer. Options on the Blazer include a comfort tilt steering wheel, air conditioning, and an AM or AM/FM radio. See and test drive a new Chevy Blazer at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo Chevrolet, directly across from the Bradley Air Museum, just a short drive from Hartford. When it comes to Chevrolets, the people at Russo are experts. So remember the name, R-U-S-S-O, Russo Chevrolet. And now, a question of George T. Simon that has been asked of me so frequently. Would the music business have been different, George, had Glenn Miller survived World War II?
I've been asked that so often, too, and I really don't know, Arnold. I think it certainly would have had an impact on music because he was such a leader. He was an innovator, and he was so commercially oriented. I think he might have done what Lawrence Welk has been doing so successfully. I'm sure that he probably would have had an extremely successful television series. And probably changed the course of music somewhat. I don't think he ever could have fought the rock age or anything like that, because that was bound to change. You can't have the same sort of music for 30 years in a row.
But he did have ideas even before he went into the service that once he came out, I think he said he was going to retire to his ranch for 6 months out of the year and play for 6 months.
And then play concerts.
Yeah.
You know, he was that far ahead. There were, you know,
sure.
Concerts came in the 50s, but Glenn was way ahead. He saw the concert field opening up already, and that's what he was going to do. He's going to do a lot of those.
Why did he decide to take that ill-fated plane trip across the English Channel?
I have no idea. It was just a stupid thing to do because nobody else was flying that day. The weather on the ground was 34 degrees, which meant it was a good deal colder higher up, of course. And on top of that, the plane had no de-icing equipment. Polly Haynes, to whom the book is dedicated, who was Glenn's secretary, or actually ran the office for him, and was Helen's closest friend, and was also married to Don Haynes, Glenn's manager, loaned me a copy of Don's diary. And in the book, I have reprinted in full everything that happened those last 3 days. And it's a scary story when you realize how stupid the whole thing was, that they really didn't have to do it. But Glenn was so impatient, so anxious to get over to Paris to get things set up for the band, which was going over in a few days, that he went ahead, possibly on a dare, I don't even know, because the lieutenant colonel whose plane he was going in was not scared of flying. Glenn was scared stiff of flying.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably said, let's go with it. The heck with it, let's take a chance. You know, the guy was that sort of a guy, apparently.
Yeah, matter of fact, he was a little apprehensive. I know that you mentioned when he got in the plane, he looked, it was a 9-passenger Norseman, as I understand it, looked around and said, hey, where are the parachutes? And the pilot said...
Lieutenant Colonel said, what's the matter, Miller? Do you want to live forever?
Yeah. Could very possibly have been, as you point out, the last words that Glenn Miller ever heard. How do you feel that your life was different, George, because you were such a close and intimate friend of Glenn Miller?
It just enriched, I guess, more than anything else, because I'd learned an awful lot about how bands were run. I learned a lot about people. I was privileged to become more or less the Glenn Miller historian because I was so close to him, because I was one of the few people at that time who had been writing all through the big band era. And I was there from the very beginning when the band first started, from his first rehearsals. I was there the last night the band played at the Central Theater in Passaic. And, of course, I was with the band in New Haven again and worked closely with Glenn in helping recruit men for the AAF band.
George, as our penultimate selection, let's listen to another one by the AAF band, borrowed from the civilian band. Here's that Volga Boatman.
Thank you.
Tell you how flattered I am, by the way, that you mentioned my name. And if I made any contribution at all, believe me, George, you've made a greater contribution to all the shows that I've done here. And I don't know what I would do without your books, honestly.
Oh, thank you. Oh, it was great. You know, I'm so appreciative for all you've done for, not just for me personally, because you've been so encouraging, but just for, even more importantly, for big band and good music. It's just great to have somebody with your authority and knowledge around and to keep these shows going.
Well, I think we have more fans in this area, perhaps, and maybe that's appropriate, too, yeah, than many other places in the country. What are you writing now?
I'm working on two books right now. One is called The Big Band Songbook. The other is something I haven't signed a contract for, so I'd rather not jinx it.
But there'll be something else going on.
Yes. Yeah.
Keep writing, George. Fine. We enjoy your books immensely, and good luck to you with this one.
Thanks so much, Arnold.
Our next one-night stand with the big bands on WTIC Radio will be presented on Thursday night, September 5th. Our guest will be Teddy Wilson, the fabulous pianist. We'll indulge in some conversation and some of the great listening to his piano stylings. Our one-night stand has been brought to you by WTIC and by Russo Chevrolet, across from the Bradley Air Museum in Windsor Locks, where both sales and service are outstanding. Engineering for tonight's production by Sam Belnius. This is your host, Arnold Dean, on WTIC Radio's One Night Stand with the Big Band.